Welcome, listeners, to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Megan Greeson, who comes to the field of understanding violence and understanding the response to violence in our communities. She comes at the work really from a systems perspective, and so looking at how different systems respond to survivors of violence, and specifically doing a lot of work around coordinated sexual assault response teams. So welcome, Dr. Greeson. Thank you so much for joining me today. And we like to start each episode with a quick who is in the room. So my first question to you is just to give us a quick overview of just who you are and a little bit of like the pathway into your work. And then what is that work or that focus that you do in the field of violence prevention?
Great. So I'm Megan Greeson. I'm an associate professor of psychology at DePaul University in Chicago. I've been engaged in the movement against violence against women or gender-based violence for over 15 years. I started out in the movement as a volunteer domestic violence community-based advocate, and then I got engaged with some research on intimate partner violence, and then from there I moved into focusing more on sexual assault. So I did the medical forensic advocate, and then have been doing research in that area. The time focuses on how formal systems respond to sexual assault and how to understand how we can improve by focusing on individual, organizational, and broader community factors. So in particular, I've done a lot of systems change and thinking through coordination and collaboration between different types of responders. So as often looking at advocates, nurses, or medical forensic providers, prosecutors, and police. And then within that, I'm often looking at formal coordinating counsels, research assault response team.
Great. And so what, what currently are you focused on in work? Like, are there specific projects that you have in the works right now?
Yeah. So I'm really excited about a project we've been working on for a couple of years now. We worked with a local rape crisis center. So you better understand your relationships with forensic nurses in the area. So, well, actually all nurses, not just forensic nurses. So here in Chicago, there's a wide variety of different hospitals and advocacy organizations provide advocacy services to a whole bunch of hospitals. And the advocacy organization was interested in how they could improve their working relationships with the nurses they're doing the exam so that they could hopefully ultimately provide better patient care, thinking that better collaboration between the professionals will lead to better outcomes for the survivor in the medical exam. So we interviewed a variety of nurses from all over Chicago and a variety of different hospitals about their experiences working with those advocates, how they understood their roles of both the nurse and the advocate, what they saw as strengths and what was working well in their relationships, and what they saw as what could be improved, and why those things matter. And so my team has been diligently pulling that data. I think it's particularly interesting because a lot of the work has focused on nurse advocacy collaboration with highly trained sexual assault nurse examiners. In our sample, we have a lot of variability of folks that have that sexual assault nurse examiner training, but also a lot of people that don't. Right? So I think it's been interesting thinking through how to improve that collaboration. And then also acknowledging those tensions around recognizing you want to collaborate well with the group, but that you also have some kind of responsibilities to your own role, right? That you still need to follow your own role as an advocate. I think we've been experiencing those tensions a lot in our data. And so I think that's some exciting stuff to get out into the world.
Yeah. So for people who might be listening who aren't as familiar with the field, could you talk, or even like a little bit of the history, could you talk a bit about kind of that those defining elements of being an advocate versus working with like the nurses in the medical field and kind of what that relationship has been like, and then why that is important to understand and build the capacity of that work?
Okay, yeah, that's helpful. Back from your audience. Yeah, so when a sexual assault survivor wants to get medical and or forensic health after the assault. You can get medical care, so things like medication for that pregnancy, treatment of any injuries, and they can also get a forensic exam. So that's commonly called a rape kit, and that's where they can collect some evidence of the crime that can be used in the prosecution of the crime if they wish to pursue that. So that here is located in an emergency room, so a survivor should look to the emergency room and they say they want those services. And at the same time, the hospital will page out a volunteer advocate from the local rape crisis center that they work with. And that advocate's role is there to support the survivor from the beginning to the end. Right, so they're there to make sure that the survivor is informed of all of their choices, what they want to do about the legal system, do they want to report it and prosecute or not? What are their options for evidence collection? What are their options and rights around medical care? So they're really there to advocate for them, make sure their needs are being met. The nurse is there then to do the healthcare and to actually do the technical aspects of the forensic evidence collection. So two different roles. They can be very complementary, but the advocate is also charged with making sure the survivor's needs are met. So if they feel for some reason that the medical providers aren't necessarily offering service, it's your job to speak up on the survivor's behalf. So it's interesting where there can be a lot of complementary roles there and a lot of mutually supporting together, working together to meet the survivor's needs. But also at times they may have to speak up and say, actually, I think she is entitled to escalate in service, or actually, I think she said she was really interested in it. So I think it's important that we do that for her, or you share that, whoever the survivor may be. So I think historically, there are some places where advocates and nurses have gotten along really well. But also in some places, it has been a little bit tense. And I think it's a little bit understandable because in some ways the advocates coming in to make sure the medical system is doing their job, right? They are there to support the survivor, but they're also there to make sure they're getting the care that they need. So I think that can sometimes put up some defenses for some folks. And so acknowledging that tension or that potential for tension, the rape crisis center and myself really wanted to better understand how can we help advocates still do what they need to do for the survivor while also establishing effective collaboration with the nurse and providing the services.
And I think that kind of what you're talking about is going to get at this question, but one of the things that we certainly want to talk about is those sort of gaps in the field and the gaps in that work. So when you're thinking about the spectrum of what you're doing now, and when you're thinking about that response to provider services, and it sounds like a lot of your focus is in medical care response. Can you talk about where you see those gaps and where the work can be going?
Yeah, so I think a lot has improved over the years, right? And that now we have specially trained nurse examiners that are all over the country. Still think we need more. in particular in Illinois, there's been some struggles to get enough folks trained to provide as much highly trained nursing coverage as we would like. So I think there's still some folks that don't have that strong expertise in medical forensic collection, working with sexual assault victims are providing that care. I think that's a gap. Were you wanting more gaps in the research or in cracking?
I mean, I'd love to hear both.
Yes. In terms of research, we've done a lot to better understand collaboration between different disciplines. We understand the importance of communication. We understand the importance of really having strong and shared understanding of what the different roles are of the different groups. You know, what is the role of the nurse versus what are the role of the advocate, and can we all get on the same page about that? We understand the importance of trying to do relationship building where people get to know each other and start to trust each other. Talking about communication and checking in with one another. How are you doing? How did that go for you? What do you think we could have done better? In a non-judgmental, non-finger-pointing way. I think there's a lot we know about what collaboration looks like when it goes well. And I think there's a lot we know about when it goes poorly, too. But I think we need more information on how to flip the switch, if that makes sense. So how do we take, for example, a nurse that feels like advocates really shouldn't have a role in the emergency room? And how can we help bring them along and see that actually, you know, policy and best practice on that the advocate in there to provide an additional support? How can we change that very in mind so that there'll be more of that collaboration? We've also done a lot on multidisciplinary responses within the context of SLARPs. So that's when you're bringing in the medical piece, the advocacy piece, and the criminal justice piece, and also other stakeholders too. And I think that we have similar questions there. I have similar questions there. We know a lot of those elements I just talked about really matter in establishing an effective collaborative team, that communication, that role understanding, building personal relationships, building positive relationships. We know what it looks like when it goes poorly, but what are the interventions or the type of education strategies that really help us switch from folks that are like, actually, I don't want to interact with, how do we help get past that? And I think a big looming question has a lot of very important implications that I don't have the answer to yet.
Yeah, that's very fair. So what you said made me think of a few things, and I guess I want to first talk about that part where you said, you know, we've seen growth in the availability of advocates and forensic nurses across the country, but that maybe there's room for growth. So I think that's one of my questions is, what is the, if at all, like, is there a standard practice around these positions or availability of resources in emergency rooms or in hospital care settings? And if there is a standard, kind of what is it? Or is it just, does it vary state to state and even, you know, county to county kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it varies quite a lot in particular from state to state. I think there's more states that are now implementing policies around what are the expectations for the medical providers, like what is their background, what is their certification, are their training that they need to be able to be the ones doing this. And I think the gold standard is doing the National Association of Forensic Nursing same training and getting that certification, but a lot of folks don't do that. In my state, they have put some resources into training folks in the state to get more same nurses. And that has greatly increased the number of same nurses, but I feel like we're still behind quite a lot of states in how available things are. Because especially here, there's not, and especially in Chicago, in that urban environment with all those hospitals, you don't necessarily have like, okay, this hospital has the same nurses, so we're going to refer to everyone to this hospital. There's not that kind of system. So I think survivors don't necessarily know, oh, I need to pick out the hospital with the great, really great nurses. And so it's a bit of a luck of the draw of who's on call in which hospital you went to, of like how much training they'll have. But again, in Illinois, they have implemented newer policies. The policies aren't even passed, but I think it's currently in implementation where they are requiring more training, but again, for nurses, but it's done by the state. And then I think a lot of state, I think there's a little bit more consistency around advocacy. That advocates are pretty widely available, although that can get trickier in geographically isolated locations, I think. And I think the barrier there is just that not always people know about them and that they're not always getting referrals. And usually a rape victim isn't necessarily going to call the rape crisis center and ask for an advocate first. Usually they'll call the police first or the medical system, they call anyone, right? Often rape crisis centers rely on police or the medical provider to bring in that advocate. And I think it's probably something that's getting better in a lot of places, but that we're also not going to get that 100% referral rate. But there are a lot of state policies that are now saying, you know, an advocate should always be called.
Yeah, And so for you, I guess going back a little bit to your pathway and your trajectory into this work, I know that you are a psychologist by background. So can you talk a little bit about the relationship to like your training and how you see these things sort of connecting from that to that discipline?
Yeah, great. I'm happy to do that. So I'm actually a community psychologist by training. So community psychology is a little bit of a less common field in psychology, but it's a sub-discipline that's really focused on individuals' well-being and behavior, but nested within broader environments, whether that's for communities or organizations or systems, right? And so we really take what we like to call an ecological approach, thinking about all of those different levels. So for me, that's really influenced, wanting to understand these different responses to survivors, not just thinking about just versus, but starting to think at a bigger level of organizational policies, organizational practices, and then the bigger team movement, like how we create relationships between them, right? So I think that's one aspect of it. I'll also say, community psychology is very grounded in thinking through social justice and understanding my understanding of gender-based violence is that it's a form of oppression, right? That disproportionately affects a variety of marginalized groups. And so trying to approach the work from that angle in remembering to think through our work with survivors from an empowerment angle, recognizing how it intersects with other forms of oppression, whether that be racism or ableism or pick your oppression, but recognizing those different layers of oppression and diversity and attending to those in the work is another thing that I've brought with me from community psychology. And we also focus a lot on both quantitative and qualitative methodology, and I've always really enjoyed that in my work with gender-based violence, especially the power of hearing people's stories and hearing people make meaning of the work. We need to have a really rich two-hour conversation with the nurse about what's it really like to work with an advocate and see you doing that while you're also treating other patients in the NAR, and what do you want to be different about that, and like having some of that rich conversation, I think it's been rewarding, while also sometimes needing that quantitative data as well.
Okay, so in what you were just saying, I think the sort of connection to methodology, the qualitative, quantitative, and being able to understand kind of the value in that really speaks to understanding how we tell a more true narrative. So can you talk a bit about how that has impacted how you view maybe the challenges that you see in the field or in your work, like being able to kind of utilize a mixed methods approach and maybe just like talk a bit about even what that looks like in terms of gathering information for you and yeah, just what feels exciting about being able to have a blend of both of those things?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I do think quantitative and qualitative have been extremely useful in my career. And whenever I have the opportunity to do what I do, try to do both to ask, kind of a related set of questions within one project. I think in the project I've been talking about the medical response and the advocate, I think one of the things I've really liked about the qualitative is kind of understanding some of that nuance. Right. So in the opportunity to develop, to hear in the nurses own words how they talk about the experience, but also to have them help take me down the road of new hypotheses. Right. So I can think of in our data, we know from the quantitative and the mixed methods literature that role understanding is really important in collaboration, effective collaborative relationships between different disciplines. And so one of the things though that we found was that the nurses tended to feel like they understood the role of the advocate, but there was variability between nurses in what they interpret that as and what they thought was appropriate. Right. So you would see the same behavior and that some people really thought that behavior was very appropriate on the part of the advocate, and other people thought that behavior was very inappropriate on behalf of the advocate. So I don't know if it's so much a question of role understanding is the exact right term anymore, because I think part of it is not understanding that upon the role. Like, they think they know what the role is, and advocate thinks they know what the role is, but they don't actually agree on it.
Sure.
So I think that was a cool nuance that came out of that data, and I think it's useful for the field to be. But I did a big national study of sexual assault response teams, and that bringing together all those different disciplines. And I had some quantitative data that helped, and that was with Rebecca Campbell of Michigan State University, my co-investigator or co-PI on that. And she and I got some good quantitative data on what appear to be some elements of team structure that appear to help start functioning well. But then we also collected some qualitative data that my team's continuing to get out. And that qualitative data within the interviews can help us to understand that we found like things like, we found that doing more things like protocol development, your evaluation, or having more formal structures to organize your team, the quantitative data suggests that seem to be correlated with perceptions of effectiveness. Then the qualitative, they would speak to, okay, we tried protocol development and this is what it looked like when it went really well, versus other people would be like, actually, protocol development didn't work so well. So it kind of helps you to unpack what are the circumstances in which this protocol development thing works and why does it seem to help the team it helps and why does it seem to detract from the teams that it didn't work for. So I think it, again, gives a bit more of that nuance and a bit more of the how and why to help enrich the story.
Absolutely. Yeah, that illustration of the connection between the narrative and then the question structure for maybe more quantitative data, I think, is really important. And at least from my perspective, very much feels like you really can't have one without the other. And feels, yeah, just really important. So you have noted a couple times SARTs or sexual assault response teams. And so I just wonder if you can give a little overview of that and maybe touch on, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't go a little bit down the connection to criminal justice elements. You know, our project, at least for the consortium, is funded through NIJ. And so understanding a bit how SARTs also assist in that justice process, in your perspective, like if at all.
Okay. Yeah. So I've done research on sexual assault response teams for a while now. These are groups that bring together different responders to sexual assault cases and victims. They typically involve advocates, police, prosecutors, and medical forensic examiners, like forensic nurses or doctors that are providing that service. They might bring in to other stakeholders in that community as well together. And they tend to operate kind of like a task force or a council, where you get representative from the different groups together. They meet and then they talk about how is our response to sexual assault going in their community? What needs to be improved and how are we going to do that? So that's kind of their fundamental process. There's a lot of different ways about going about that. There's a lot of cool toolkits and resources out there for folks that are interested in that, especially the NSDRC and the OVC, National Sexual Violence Resource Center and the Office on Victims of Crime. Both of those have good resources on SARTs. They tend to focus on kind of dual goals of one being, how are we going to improve victims' experiences of seeking help? Whether that be kind of reducing barriers to getting help, or once they are receiving help, how they making sure that they're getting really comprehensive services, and then it's all very trauma-informed and focused on what the survivor wants. That tends to be one major focus. And often the second focus is really improving criminal justice system outcomes. So things like getting more survivors to be willing to report, improving investigation processes, improving prosecution processes, so that ultimately more cases will move forward in the criminal justice system. So that's the thing that those are common goals of SARTs. In terms of the research there, it's not always the strongest research. There's some evidence We do some systematic review on this a while back, and there's definitely some evidence that SARTs can contribute to improvements in some communities. With that said, there's also a lot of evidence that SARTs are really hard to implement, and it's really hard. If we think about the roles of advocates versus police and prosecutors versus nurses, they all have different aims and different ways of approaching the work. They're pretty different. And so it can be really hard to get SARTs off the ground and to kind of find common ground of how we all want to work together and how we want to bring each other work rather than working more separately. So I think SARTs aren't a universal magic wand for improving prosecution rate, but it's a great option to try and to really kind of invest in learning from the resources and the research that's out there about how to do a SART well. And I think that's going to give it the best chance of seeing those prosecution outcomes and giving them a bump upwards.
Thank you for... Yeah, that was great. Yeah, that was awesome. I like to wrap up with like a last question of about just again where you see things going. So like if someone were to hand you a unrestricted pot of money to do whatever kind of research or next set of projects that you would do, what would you do? What would be your priority area, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think there's been a lot of sexual assault in the past, you know, even just the past 5 years. There's been a ton of policy changes around trying to improve response to survivors. And I know a lot of intention has been focused on the kit and the rape kit platforms that folks have seen. And I'd like to more focus on how some of the changes in policy have affected how nurses and police are approaching the work of the kit. Is it changing how they're interacting with survivors? Is it changing survivors' experiences? Are survivors receiving more comprehensive care? Is there better coordination in the care that they receive? Is that leading to better outcomes? So I think looking at some of those big sweeping policy changes, are those really having the impact that we want them to? How are they actually implemented on the ground? I think it's a really important question, and I'd love to ask that. I'm going to cheat and give you two.
It's unrestricted money, you know? So, like, we'll do whatever.
You can cut one if you don't. So, I think the other one I would say is, and I don't, this isn't a fully formed question yet, this isn't a fully formed project yet, but just understanding the limits of collaboration, right? That we tend to see collaboration as a good thing across different disciplines. And I do believe that. And I think there might be some limits to that interpreting around, like I said, there's instances when an advocate can't take a collaborative route. And you need to say, actually, the survivor is entitled to the service and you need to provide that. So I think exploring that edge of when do we switch from collaboration to almost confrontation. And how do you do that? And how do you maintain full are like really big questions that I don't know the answer to, but I don't even know exactly how to ask them yet. But I think that would be a cool thing to get some smart people together and talk about and figure out.
Can you talk a little bit about why you see that being important? You know, understanding that edge, like what about that is valuable?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, there's some evidence that suggests that talks about the danger of co-optation, right? And that maybe sometimes that we focus so much on collaboration that we might be afraid to critique, right? And so that even see this from SARTs, you're supposed to be very collaborative of like, people are afraid to say to a different discipline, actually, I think that was a problem. Actually, I think that was harmful to that survivor, or whatever the critique might be. Because they're so invested in maintaining that relationship that they don't want to speak up on behalf of survivors or whatever it needs to be. So I think having a better understanding of some guidelines for people about like, when do you need to be really relational? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any, or I guess maybe closing thoughts? And then also, how can people find you or learn more about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so it was really great to be a part of this. Thanks for having me. So if you want to learn more about my work, you can check me out on the DePaul website, at DePaul University in Chicago. Again, Megan Griffin. Within that, you know, you can email me and learn more about my work, right on the website, megangriffinresearch.com. So those are all great ways to get a hold of me. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciated you sharing your experience and your work with us. And, you know, fingers crossed that we all end up with that, you know, unrestricted pot of money so that we can just change the world with all our cool research projects, you know?
Yeah. I mean, let me know when that's coming.
I will.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.